Hey there, it's Stuart here. Welcome to the iFormerX podcast, and thanks for joining us on a journey to explore the evidence that matters in ambulatory care, community, and geriatric pharmacy practice. If you are not already a member of iFormerX, I encourage you to head on over to our website, iFormerX.org, and click on the Join or Sign In link that's in that upper right of the navigation bar. It's easy to join, and it's free to health professionals or those training to become a health professional. If you want to achieve optimal health outcomes, it's important to address each patient's health-related needs in a holistic manner. For example, prescribing the perfect medication to treat hypertension won't result in a positive outcome if the patient can't afford the medication, or if the patient doesn't have access to low-sodium foods, or if the patient lives in a pharmacy desert and doesn't have an affordable means of transportation, or if the patient feels unwelcome in your practice and therefore is unlikely to return for follow-up visits. We've grown to appreciate the fact that social factors, factors that are unrelated to physiology, pathophysiology, or biology, are just as important, and perhaps more important, to achieving optimal health. We call these social factors the social determinants of health, or SDOH. But screening for and addressing these factors in practice has some major challenges. First, most of us don't have an efficient and systematic way of identifying these factors during patient encounters. And second, even if an efficient mechanism were available, would patients be forthcoming when answering questions about their social circumstances? And third, would clinicians actually use the results of a social determinants of health screening to make better informed decisions and interventions? These are all great questions, and we're starting to see some evidence published in the literature to help guide us. That's why I invited Sharmona Sai from the University of Georgia to write a commentary about a recently published research report from a health system that implemented SDOH screening in their family medicine and internal medicine clinics. Dr. Osai is a clinical associate professor of pharmacy practice with the College of Pharmacy and a clinical pharmacy specialist at Phoebe Primary Care at Northwest in Albany, Georgia. Sharmona was the first author of two invited papers on health disparities published in JACCP a couple of years ago, and I knew she'd be the perfect person to review this paper. So, Sharmona, I'm so grateful you accepted my invitation to write this commentary and to be on the iFormerX podcast today.
Thank you for having me. I am a big fan of iFormerX, and I am immensely grateful for the opportunity to speak with you today on a topic as important as this one.
Yeah, so before we talk about the study, Sharmona, I was hoping that you could give us some context. As I alluded to in the introduction, there are a number of social factors that impact our health and can either be facilitators or barriers to the health goals we hope to achieve for ourselves and with our patients. Tell us a bit more about these factors and why there is increasing awareness of their importance.
When I introduce individuals to the concepts within SDOH, I typically direct them to the framework that taught me, which originates from the World Health Organization. It's also been adapted by the CDC here in the US, and it defines SDOH as conditions in which people are born, grow, work, live, and age that have a wider set of forces and shape the conditions of their daily lives and can have positives or negative impacts on their health outcomes. These factors influence health equity, health disparities, all in positive and negative ways. And agendas within the CDC here in the US, such as Healthy People 2030, actually highlight five key domains of social determinants of health. The five domains that they utilize include economic stability, an example of which could be having employment or not having employment, neighborhood and built environment, which could include man-made buildings or neighborhood structures, education access and quality, which includes concepts like early childhood education and language, social and community contexts, including civic participation, perhaps discrimination, and finally, what might be more near and dear to us as pharmacists, is healthcare access and quality, which includes concepts like access to care. Now, social determinants of health have existed for decades, but interestingly enough, during the pandemic, there was this heightened awareness of health disparities and therefore a heightened awareness of social determinants of health and how these factors impact the pandemic as well as the treatment of chronic diseases during the pandemic and now after. This increased awareness has also been crucial in the U.S. because our healthcare system is trying to move from this fee-for-service to a pay-for-performance space. So even though at initial glance, people might think that health is guided solely by personal choices, you know, if you eat right and exercise, you'll be healthy. This is flawed. We've had literature show us that in the past, our individual actions cannot, should not, and are not the only avenues to positive and negative health outcomes. Let's say our health is 100%. Personal choice can account for about 30% of that. Our clinical care, maybe 20%. But then the physical environment, social, economical, and structural factors amounts to 50%. It's the largest category. And those are things that sometimes we don't have full capacity or control over.
So, Charmone, I'd like to take a closer look at this particular study that you reviewed and wrote a commentary about. The title of the paper is Patient and Care Team Perspectives on Social Determinants of Health Screening in Primary Care, a Qualitative Study. And it's published in JAMA Network Open. As always, we provide a link to that paper on our website. But, Charmone, can you fill us in on the study methods and some of the key findings?
The study was designed to answer whether there are any patient or clinician factors associated with early implementation of SDOH screening in primary care specifically. They also aimed to determine some strategies to help improve the screening efforts within large healthcare systems. They utilized a qualitative and quantitative analysis approach, and their primary outcome was the SDOH screening completion status, comparing visits with any screening, whether it was complete or partial, with no screening at all. As stated, this study was conducted in both family and internal medicine practices within a northwestern region of South Carolina between February of 2022 to May of 2022. And within that time frame, they reviewed almost 148,000 practice visits. They found that 53% of those visits occurred in the family medicine setting, while approximately 47% occurred in the internal medicine setting. And when they compared the SDOH screening completion between MDs and physician assistants actually had a statistically significant greater odds of completing the screening, while nurse practitioners had statistically lower odds of completing it. It also found that patients who identified with racial and ethnic backgrounds were more likely to have screening compared to those who identified as white. And finally, the qualitative analysis found 7 themes regarding barriers and facilitators to the implementation of SDOH from healthcare team member interviews, and patient experts provided 5 overarching themes to aid in appropriate implementation.
So one thing that struck me, Charmone, about the findings from this study is actually the relatively small percentage of the visits with an SDOH screening completed. So about 3.5% of the visits had either a complete or partial SDOH screening documented. And when a screen was completed, again, it was surprising to me that only a small percentage of the screening items were positive. Typically, only 1 to 3% of the population screened actually had a positive finding. And typically, it was like financial strain or transportation issues or housing insecurity. To me, this suggests the population that was seen in these clinics is relatively well off, or the screening process itself is flawed, or maybe patients are just reluctant to accurately report their concerns. That's why the qualitative findings are so critical, I think, here, because they can reveal things that we can only speculate about when looking at the quantitative data. So that's my question to you. What stood out to you about the qualitative data?
There are actually 4 things that really stood out to me regarding the qualitative data. And that the first being that it involved end users in the evaluation. So getting the thought processes of those who are going to deliver the tool, as well as those who are or could be receiving the tool, to impact that implementation of how to screen, I felt was vitally important to smooth rollout in different settings. And so that was my first thought. Like, they really did find the right people to evaluate qualitatively. The second was, there was this very unique element of patient experts, which they defined as individuals with substantial health system interaction who were trained in communication and research methods from the University of South Carolina Patient Engagement Studio. So prior to the interviews, that patient expert feedback was gathered to incorporate into the research process. And I think having those patient experts and their input provided a unique element and perspective to this research. The third was that they made it very clear that data saturation was reached for the qualitative analyses. And so when you reach data saturation, it suggests that you've achieved in highlighting the collection of very rich, in-depth information, which is typically the goal of qualitative sampling techniques. And finally, I felt that the findings were actionable items that could very well be generalized to other healthcare systems. When we evaluated the themes gathered from the patient care team members, they identified facilitators such as having practice champions and focusing on the actual communication between the patient and the clinician. And they identified barriers that other healthcare systems could avoid, such as making sure that questions and content didn't overlap and ensuring that patients had a clear understanding of what the screening was for and how it was meant to help, as well as the patient experts. Great themes to help for practices in the future of, hey, maybe you should conduct this screening in a private location. Make sure that you're following up with patients on the referrals that come from the screening instead of just screening and leaving as is. And then ensuring that health literacy is being considered as these questions are developed and the screening tool is implemented. And so if another institution wanted to implement this type of screening, there were really great tips and pearls on how they could avoid pitfalls and capitalize on some of the facilitators that were found in this health system.
So, Charmaine, do you think the findings of this study are generalizable to the average primary care practice in the United States? And given that only a small percentage of patients were actually screened, do you think it's worth the time and effort to do these screenings?
That's a great question. First and foremost, I think regardless of the small percentage, I truly believe it's worth the time and effort to screen. I would love to say that there's an average primary care practice, but I don't believe there is. I'll never forget when I practiced at the VA, they had a saying that if you've seen one VA, you've only seen one VA. And I feel like that's the same when we talk about primary care practices across the nation. They are all so different in their own ways. And so I do think that each practice should consider how they can conduct their own needs assessment or implementation plan to roll out some form of SDOH screening in their communities. I think this is a great place for EDSA cycles or maybe Lean Six Sigma. I think those concepts could help those institutions roll these types of things out. And I'd love to see healthcare systems get to a point where every patient is screened annually for SDOH challenges. But I think that might be a bit of a reach right now. I'm no AI expert, artificial intelligence, but what I do feel is once we can identify how artificial intelligence can work for the benefit of something like this, it may be really beneficial to identify those patients with specific criteria to screen, and that might be a more doable task. Now, this isn't an exhaustive list, but I think data from the EHR that could be used to trigger SDOH screening could include, but it's definitely not limited to, possibly the number of no-show appointments that a patient has, the number of admits to the hospital if you're connected in with the hospital system's EHR, possibly a certain number of comorbidities, patient's refill adherence information if you're connected to that type of data, and finally, maybe even overdue bill statuses. All of these things and possibly more can be helped to trigger to say, hey, maybe this person could use a screen for SDOH challenges or issues. And I think once that person is screened and identified, then administering a validated tool that is available to screen for SDOH could be useful. But what I think is most important is recognizing this is not a one-size-fits-all solution. It will need to be individualized to ensure that there is a workflow in place that works for that practice.
Charmone, thank you so much for being here today on the iFormerX podcast to discuss this study. And I think we can all agree that social factors play a crucial role in health outcomes. And if we want our patients to achieve and maintain optimal health, we can't just ignore these factors. But I think there's a lot of unanswered questions. How should we screen patients and how often? What should we do when a patient screens positive? What interventions can we practically implement to address some of these factors? Or is the purpose of screening to better understand population-wide issues and needs so that we can address them at a public health level, creating population-wide interventions? Tell us what you think. This is an important topic, and we'd love to hear your thoughts about social determinants of health screening and what you do in your practice. And if you like this podcast, please take a moment to rate us using your favorite podcast app and leave a comment. We don't have a marketing budget, so your positive comments and 5-star ratings really help get the word out to new subscribers. And by the way, if you are a board-certified geriatric pharmacist, you can earn board recertification and continuing education credit for listening to this podcast and reading the written commentary. We've partnered with the American Pharmacists Association to create the Literature Evaluation Evidence-Based Practice Series, and you can learn more about that program by clicking on the link just below the written commentary on our website. And lastly, I want to thank all the people, faculty and staff, who work in experiential learning offices, coordinating all the assignments of students, orienting and educating new preceptors, troubleshooting problems, and being there to coach students and preceptors when they are struggling. In most health professional degree programs, experiential education represents at least 25% of the curriculum, and I would argue from a learning perspective, it's the most transformative, and all of this work is typically managed by just a few people. So my hat's off to all of the experiential program directors, coordinators, and staff who are in the trenches every day doing a demanding job that is often underappreciated and underrecognized. Until the next time, this is Stuart Haynes, Editor-in-Chief of iFormerX, signing off.